From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
A childlike man is not a man whose development has been arrested. On the contrary, he is a man who has given himself a chance of continuing to develop long after most adults have muffled themselves in the cocoon of middle-aged habit and convention.
I didn't know we were allowed to muffle ourselves.
On the philosophy of men cometh.
There you go. Aldous Huxley said that. Now, do you know that by the end of his life, Huxley was widely acknowledged as one of the preeminent intellectuals of his time? So to all you childlike men and us childlike men, yeah, I say, welcome to episode 113 of The Dice Men Cometh on the 14th of April, 2016. I'm Mark.
I'm Garth.
I'm Leon.
And Garth.
What have we got on this show?
What? I was just going to ask you.
Oh, Mark. We are going to start, well, basically, no, we're going to have pretty much a full episode of what we've been playing this week, because one of the Dice Men turned 14 or 15 or some, you know, number in his life cycle, which involved 12 hours of gaming. So we've played all the games this week. So we're going to start with a game, then we'll talk about another game, which will lead us into talking about more games. That's what we've got.
Now, before we go into the musical interlude, though, we must pause to reflect for a second.
May the force be with us. It's a trap.
So this, or not this week, but a few days back, we lost a man who no one will know his name, Eric Bowersfeld. However, he was a radio actor who provided that iconic voice, that of Admiral Akbar.
Wow.
And, you know, that the two of those, but particularly It's a Trap, would have to be, you know, some of the most iconic lines from the original Star Wars trilogy. And did you know, guys, he also provided the voice of Bib Fortuna, the major domo in Jabba's lair with the big tentacly thing around his head. I'm not sure what race those guys are. But Twi'lek, is that them?
Sure. Yes, it is.
Something like
that.
Yeah,
I played one of those in The Edge of the Empire.
There you go.
Yeah.
So
Twinkies, one of them.
So Eric Bowersfeld, a salute to you, sir.
R.I.P., hey?
He did live, I think he was in his 90s, actually.
Oh, well done.
And apparently the story was, he walked into the radio studio. He was a friend of one of the sound editors or something. And they said, look, this character. And they showed him a picture and make up a voice. And he did it on the spot, pretty much. And that was the voice they went with.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, you look at the character model. It's got big old lips and stuff. So he's got to go, it's got a trap. It's a trap. And that's pretty much what he did.
Anyway, we will go something like this.
That was the Chemical Brothers with Get On Up It Like This.
Close.
That'll do. It was a very, very good song. But anyway, Mark, you're going to turn it down a notch.
We are.
And go serious.
August the 2nd, 1914. In the main square of the village, a group of inseparable friends contemplate incredulously a general mobilization order posted on the town hall. For several weeks, reading the news had become very worrying, but the brutality of this announcement surprised everyone. Without having the slightest idea of the hell which they were about to be put into, they promised to stay together, to return whatever happened. Unfortunately, the reality that they were about to face would be completely beyond their worst fears. Like literature and film, gaming is a cultural medium, undeniably participative. There is no subject that can't be covered. Some are more difficult to cope with than others, particularly the life of Les Poilus, the Hairies. Guided by the deepest respect we hold for the suffering endured by these men, we have worked hard to design and set this game with this in mind. In this collective madness, we have chosen to put them in front of their concerns, their daily fears. The only way out for these men was their solidarity, their brotherhood, their ability to help themselves to rescue one and all. Without ever addressing fighting, Le Poilu offers each player the chance to experience some of the difficulties experienced by the soldiers in the trenches. The atmosphere around the table will often not only be intense, but emotional as well. The path to victory will seem difficult, but do not be discouraged. Press forward and experience the Great War!
Wowzers!
That is the translation of the introduction in the French rulebook of Le Poilu, or the Hairies, which has now become, in English, the Grizzled.
Mm.
Garth.
Yeah, so this game, The Grizzled, which the English version published by Cool Mini or Not, and designed by Fabian Riffold, and Juan Rodriguez, was only released last year. It's a 2-5 player hand management co-op deck game where you are trying to survive World War One. So it's a pretty heavy topic. For what is a very small but very beautiful, and not surprisingly, because the theme is World War One, bloody difficult game.
Yes, absolutely. And just to mention, it was a company I hadn't actually heard of before, Sweet November, who put out the French version. I believe it was about February or March this year, and some of our listeners may even remember we discussed it very briefly. Not in this year, in 2015.
That's right.
Some of our listeners may remember we touched on it just briefly when I had listened to an episode of The Spiel, and they talked about this French version and how quite a impressive little game it was.
Yeah, well, it had one hell of a 2015. It was the 2015 Golden Geek Best Board Game Artwork and Presentation nominee. I'm sure we'll get back to the art. It was 2015 Golden Geek Best Card Game nominee, the 2015 Golden Geek Best Innovative Board Game nominee, and the 2015 Golden Geek Best Thematic Board Game nominee. Mm. So, as far as a game goes, that's not bad.
Hang on, I've got to jump in on that. The thematic one, that was won by Pandemic Legacy, was it not?
Mm.
That is about the biggest injustice in awards I think I've ever heard. That is absolute garbage. You know, I'm probably giving it away now that I really, really like this game. And I think it's very close to the most thematic game I've ever played.
Which, that's an amazing thing to say, considering this game consists of 59 cards. So basically a regular size deck of cards.
And a tiny box.
And a tiny box, which even when you look at the box, you know that you've got a pretty good feeling that it's something special just because of the art and the evocative nature of it. But how do you play this game? As I say, it's a 2-5 player co-op. You are playing as the Grizzled. You will get to choose from 6 potential soldiers who are serving on the front line. And the way it's going to start is we will, very thematically, by the hairiest player at the table, choose who our mission leader will be. And the mission leader is going to choose how tough he's going to create a mission for his comrades, for his fellow troops. Now, there's this one deck of cards that we talked about. You're going to divide that deck into two piles. One pile is going to be the morale pile, which if morale ever drops to 0 and you can see the bottom card, which is basically a monument card that is a statue. It has the names of all 6 potential soldiers on there. If that ever drops to 0, we've lost, well, or at least we haven't survived the war. The second pile, which is 25 of the cards, is the trials pile. Now, at the very bottom of that is the peace card. And if, as a team, we ever get to the bottom of that pile, and none of us have any cards in our hand, we've survived World War One, guys. Well done!
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Vive la victory? Something
yes.
Like that. Sure. So anyway, once the mission leader has determined how difficult the mission's going to be, that determines how many cards from the trials pile is going to be handed out. So Mark, if you're the mission leader, because you are clearly the hairiest, you choose a mission toughness of 3. Each player will get 3 cards. Now, on these cards will be either one or any combination of 6 possible threats on the card, which are graphically represented by beautiful little drawings. You will have, I guess, you'll have the conditions. So you'll have night as a threat, you'll have rain as a threat, you'll have snow as a threat. Now, anyone who knows anything about World War One, and most of the wars in the early 19th or 20th centuries, I guess, will know that weather plays a massive, massive part in this. You will then have three other threats, which are the masks, i.e. gas, shells, i.e. bombing, and the whistles, which is tweet, tweet, we're going over the top, boys, into that machine gun fire.
Which is not what you want to hear.
No, you don't really want to hear that. Once everyone's got their cards, starting with the mission leader, they're going to play one of their cards face up into a shared central tableau called No Man's Land, and they'll play a face card which will have one of those six symbols, possibly one or two or three or four or even the dreaded card, and there's only one in the deck, that has all six potential threats on it, which is one damn nasty card. And then going around in turn order, each player is going to then play one of their own cards face up. Now, the only thing that we really need to keep track of is that the mission will be a failure as soon as there are three of any of the same type of threat out on the board. So theoretically, you should be able to get 12 cards out in a mission, hey, Leon?
Yeah, sure, 12.
Yeah, theoretically. 12. And that would be fantastic to get rid of 12 cards.
Yeah.
But if you're playing a four-player game and you're choosing a mission difficulty of three, that's only 12 cards in your hand anyway, so you're going to not really have advanced too much, because if the mission succeeds, those 12 cards go into a discard pile, which is great because your threat deck, which is what the piece card is on top of, is getting smaller. If you fail that mission, all of those cards get reshuffled into the threat deck, plus all of the cards in everyone's hands count. You count them up and move cards from the morale pile to the threat pile, and you've then got to go choose a new mission leader. They will choose how tough the next mission is, and you go round and round and round. Now, obviously, what you want to be doing is succeeding missions, but you also want to be succeeding missions with the fewest possible number of cards in each player's hand, because more often than not, that's where the majority of cards move from that morale pile across to the threat pile, purely because the other thing you can do is, as a player, you can withdraw from the current mission, which is something that you will do quite a lot, because there will be a situation where, as a player, the only cards I can play to the table are ones which will make that third symbol out or that third condition out. And you don't want to ruin the mission for everyone because you're hoping that the players around the table have cards that might be useful. Now, if you do manage to withdraw, you've then got these three little support tokens which you will be able to place in secret. The support tokens have a little left symbol or a right symbol, or maybe two to the left or two to the right. And what you're signifying there is that you've survived that conflict. You've managed to make your way off the front line and have a bit of rest, but you know that one of your fellow soldiers needs it more. So you're going to place a support token saying, Leon, you look awful. I'm going to support you.
Cheers. It's all French for cheers.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Le cheers.
Yeah, and the reason that Leon, apart from really looking awful, is that as well as the six threats that you have, there are also what's called hard knocks in this game, which, unlike other threats, they're not played to the central No Man's Land tableau. They're played against your character. Now, these are so thematic, and they are so appropriate for World War One, because they are things like fragile. They are things like hard-headedness. They are things like selfishness. There are things which is very, very simple, which is you've got a phobia against the night, because thematically, last night you might have been petrified because there were shells going off, or you almost got your head blown off, or whatever the case may be.
Or standing in a stew that used to be your best friend.
Exactly right. And these don't just go away unless at the end of the mission, when hopefully everyone has been able to survive and withdraw. If one player gets the most support tokens out of everyone, they will have the ability to remove two of the hard knocks, which is a very powerful thing to be able to do. But I'm sure you agree with me, guys, that more often than not,
yeah,
that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because even though you can talk about it, you've only starting the game with three tokens, and once you give tokens away, you don't get them back at the start of another mission. So you might have given, I might have given Leon one of my support tokens, but Mark, you might have noticed that someone to your left or your right needed them more, and you've given your support token that way. So it's tough.
Which, again, is another little thematic thing. Every tiny bit of this game is thematic, and that support token thing is the sense that there's only so much support you can give when you're exhausted yourself, even though you're standing toe-to-toe with your brothers. There's only so much you can take.
Exactly right. And the last thing that's part of the... Sorry, there's two more things. One is that each of the characters has a once-per-game ability. They start with their lucky side up, and each of the six characters has a symbol affecting one of the six threats. You can flip your card over at any stage during the game as one of your actions, and that will remove one of the cards from No Man's Land which has that particular symbol on it. But you want to be playing that card on one of the cards that has not just your symbol, but it might be a whistle at night, or it might be a snowy bullet, or whatever the case might be.
One of the triple threat cards.
Yeah, exactly right. And then the very last thing, which you only get at the end of your first mission, is a speech token. And the speech token is a very, very powerful token, which again can be used as any part of whoever's got its action. And that is, gentlemen, we're on the front line, but I'm giving a rousing speech, and my speech is going to be about, don't worry about those pesky bullets, we can dodge them. And that allows every player to discard one of the cards from their hand that has that symbol or that weather condition. And that is amazingly powerful.
Yeah. Now, look, before we get into more detail about what we think of the game, I've got to mention the art. And I think one of the things that, if you like, increases the gravitas that this game has is knowing that the art was done by a guy who goes by the name of Tignus. Now, his real name is Bernard Velac. He started out as a comic artist, and then he worked, and you may know this name, on the French publication Charlie Hebdo, along with other French news and current affairs publications. He was actually active in the French role-playing world, and his illustrations featured in games like Rêve de Dragon and Mega, and many illustrations for the magazine Casus Belli. He was a member of Cartoonists for Peace, as well as the Presse Judiciaire, an association of French journalists covering the legal system. So he was always talking about justice and fairness and everything. He was one of the founding sponsors of Clowns Sans Frontières, the Clowns Without Barriers. Mm-hmm. And he participated in a lot of their projects all around the world. And then in 2010, he published a book featuring cartoons of his signature pandas to benefit the French chapter of the World Wildlife Foundation. And they called him a friend of the pandas and of the earth. Now, of course, Bernard Velac, or Tignus, was killed in the terrorist attack against Charlie Hebdo. And for me, as I said, like, not only is this a very dramatic and confronting theme, but then to think that the artwork was done by this guy and what happened to him and all the things he stood for, to me that just even adds to the gravitas. And look, the art is absolutely beautiful. So thematic, it fits perfectly. It's very, very French.
Yep.
It looks like that period art. It reminds me of a lot of other early French stuff. I absolutely love the art. Very evocative.
Yeah, I just love the attention to detail to it, because you pick up the box and you go, wow, that looks fantastic. Then you open the box and the art continues all in the inner lid and the very bottom of it, and there's not a spare surface on this box. Then you look at the rule book and it's the same, and it's all, it's not duplicated at all. Yeah. It's all individual, purposely designed pieces of art that just suck you in. And I'm sure, you know, obviously it was deliberate to make it look like it was of the you know, early 20th century again. And it just fits superbly.
Mm. Yes.
So we played this game several times on Leon's birthday.
Yes.
I've then played the game several times, one day later, when we got together, Mark, for our bi-weekly Cthulhu campaign.
Yes.
This game, for what is essentially something about the size of a deck of cards, is a phenomenal experience, because this just requires so much teamwork, so much strategy, so much cooperation, and then sprinkled with one hell of a lot of luck to be able to continue, because, like World War One, it's a hell of a bitch. This is one tough game.
And you feel like the theme has you, that the threats are pressing in from all around you. You never know whether it's going to be
a shell or the snow or the rain or, you know, what's going to finish you off. Your friends are suffering from all these conditions. I mean, a classic was Trent was selfish. And he was a few other conditions as well.
Yeah, but what about his character?
Yeah. And the selfish had him taking all those support tokens every turn. So it got to the stage where almost no one had, or he had to vote for himself.
Yeah, all the support tokens were reversed back to him. So yeah, he was unable to support any
of us. So it's like he was sucking the support out of the whole group, which made it really, really difficult. And, you know, once you build up those conditions, there's just nothing you can do.
No, it's tough.
You're just sort of staring into the abyss and it's staring back at you. And look, I loved it. I don't think you can say it's fun because it's such an intense experience, but I happily will play it at a moment's notice. I really, really loved it.
Yeah, I agree. And the funny thing is, the closest we have come to any victory, and we have not had one victory yet in the probably 7 games that I've played of it now, was the very, very first one, where it was just freshly out of the box, and we just somehow had a strategy or the right deck of cards or the right hand each that just worked. So, look, for a game that goes on or under 30 minutes, it is well worth whatever the asking price is. Don't you reckon, Leon?
I certainly do. Two things first. Even though you just explained it quite eloquently, Garth, thank you very much. Thank you. And I watched some videos and stuff on YouTube before I played this as well. I still didn't really get it. Like, even when I'm watching people play it, I still didn't kind of understand. So this is a game, you might have guessed from what we've been saying, that we recommend. I think everyone should play it because seeing it played, and after a few seconds of a round, it made a lot more sense.
Yep.
And also, I'm going to try to do this quickly and not go into a tangent, but to understand why I say this game is so thematic and so good is that you need to know a little bit about World War One, which a lot of people don't. A lot of people know things about World War Two, and the reason for that is because World War Two, in a lot of people's eyes, is a bit more cut and dry. It's a bit more, they're evil, they were good, even though that's not necessarily cut and dry, but that's the gist of it. And there were wins and there were losses, and people understood it. World War One was just a cluster of mayhem and insanity. Why it started, all the things that happened in it, and also most of the battles that happened in it had pretty much no result to them whatsoever, other than I wanted to go this way, well, we're not going to let you. And then that
a
was
a lot of people just died on both sides.
And considering that this war, the reason it was called the First Great War is because the world had never seen anything like this before. People in this war died more in one day than had in previous wars that lasted 10 years. And when it first started, where this is set in France, French officers used to ride into war at the start with like their horses and their sword and their regal uniforms. And even the guys that conscripted, it was considered like a big adventure to go out to war. And it was an honorable thing to do. But then things like gas started coming into it, where you would literally see thousands of men melt. And there's nothing honorable about that at all. It was hell on earth. J.R.R. Tolkien was actually involved in World War One, and he got his inspiration for Mordor, which it sounds kind of joking, but that's the truth, because of World War One, because some of the fields, especially in France, where this was probably the worst section of the war, the ground was just covered in nothing but black and red, and that was from debris and dirt and blood and guts from humans and horses. It was absolutely horror. And that's where I think the theme especially shows in this game, because everything you do is hard, as the way that it should be. And some people might say, well, it's a co-op game, but you can't communicate with your friends about the cards in your hand. That's a bit weird. That's because in World War One, you could be 2 feet away from your best friend, but during the snow or the rain or the shelling or whatever else, you could be screaming your lungs out and they wouldn't be able to hear a thing, because it's just mayhem all around.
Exactly. I love as well that aspect of, you know, we could be standing side by side in the trenches, but you have no idea of the horrors that are going on in my head, and I have no ideas of the horrors that are going on in your head, because it was so horrible.
Yeah, exactly. All you want to do is protect your friends, and half the people that were there, like I said, they joined the war because they wanted an adventure, and they just didn't know what they were getting into, and most of them didn't know what they were fighting for. Even to this day, you can read books about World War One, and you kind of go, what was the point of... So I could not recommend this game any higher.
Exactly. Agreed. Go out and play it for the experience. You won't play it once, I can guarantee you that. It's kind of like, you know, code names, isn't it? You just want to rinse and repeat and go, we can do better, we can work together better, we can solve this mission. It's an amazing, from the moment you pick it up, yeah. That's
what
all.
What will you do when the war is bad?
That was Billy Bragg with Tender Comrades here on the Dice Men Cometh Edge Radio 99.3 FM with Mark, Garth and Leon. Now, let's come back from that. That was a fairly dour 20 minutes talking about a fantastic little game. Wow, that was a long conversation. We've got other games to talk about.
Exactly right. So just very, very briefly, I wanted to make mention that the Grizzle does have an expansion that I'm not sure. I think it's sort of on the verge of coming out in Australia, which is called At Your Orders. Now, what this does is create solitaire play for this game. It also ramps up the rules for two players, because even though it's a two-player game, it does basically have the secret third-person mechanic in there, which is used by a lot of games that probably shouldn't have just play for two players. But it also gives you mission cards. Now, mission cards, the mission leader will draw two of them, choose whichever one they want, and that is going to set certain restrictions on the number of cards you get dealt, or it might be that you can have four of a type of threat before you fail. Oh. So no doubt whoever owns this game, i.e. me, will be getting that. So there you go. Now, from one war to another, eh, lads? It is a period of civil war.
Bum, bum, bum.
The last remnants of the old republic have been swept away, and the empire rules the galaxy by fear. Its newly constructed battle station, the Death Star, is powerful enough to destroy any opposition. Yet there is a new hope. A brave few have chosen to stand against the Empire. From their secret base, these rebels are making plans to deal the Empire a crushing blow and restore freedom to the galaxy.
Yay! Yay, freedom!
Now this game, and we are talking about Star Wars Rebellion.
That little game.
That little game from that little publisher known as Fantasy Flight.
Who?
Has been hovering at number one on the hotness for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and within the top couple of few ever since this was announced. Now, this game only came out on March 31 for its worldwide global release, so it is only a fortnight old. It is by Fantasy Flight's favourite designer, who you can pronounce, Mark.
Corey Konietzka.
Thank you very much. This is a 2-4 player, and we will get to that 2, 3, and 4 player in a little while. Mammoth game, Rebels vs. Empire, where you will be playing basically for the hearts and minds of the Star Wars galaxy and all its inhabitants in a not compact 3 to 4 hours of playing fun. Now, I don't know really where we should start in this, because if I told you how to play it, we'll be here until midnight.
Yeah.
But I guess the easy way is that let's start with the scale of this game. This game starts with two game boards, which fill up the better part, nay, the whole part of a 8-person table, I reckon, when you've got all of the bits and pieces out, of which there are over 150 minis of various sizes. You've got the little X-wings and Y-wings, which might just be a bit bigger than your thumbnail, up to the Death Stars, of which there are three, which are about the size of a golf ball each, and they're on a little standee. You've got the Star Destroyers, which are, you know, your little arrow shapes, and they're quite impressive. But then you have the Super Star Destroyers, which are about twice their size and would make arguably a good stirrer for a nice cocktail. This game has a lot of bits and pieces to it, but what I love about it is that it is not hard to play. The rule book, and I'm going to say it, is not completely horrible.
I
am talking about a Fantasy Flight rulebook. Now, of course, there is all this discussion about, yes, it's another hard-to-read Fantasy Flight rulebook, but let's compare it very quickly to, say, Android, which has 64 pages of gobbledygook.
Yeah.
This is 20 pages where, yes, you will refer to them a lot, but it makes sense and it is quite simple and quite easy to get the gist of it with only the help of the quick reference guide, which is at the very back of the rule book. There is then a supporting rule book, of course there is, which is essentially how do you handle those 50-50 situations where you're just not quite sure. And again, it generally makes sense. So I want to say thank you, Fantasy Flight. I understood the majority of this rule book, so that was a nice surprise. Now, how this game is going to start, and I must say, with the two games that I've played, both times we used the suggested first player setup, and purely that was in the interests of speeding up the setup process, but also making sure that we didn't start by cocking it up and making the game experience too overbalanced to one side. Because then what's going to happen is three phases, which are, I guess they go quite seamlessly. The first one's going to be your assignment phase. Now, the assignment phase is your hand management part of this. So there is a rebel deck of mission cards. There is an imperial deck of mission cards. You will draw a couple of those cards every round. You will start the game with four, entry-level mission cards, of which every time you play them, you will get back into your hand. Any subsequent mission cards you draw from the deck, they're a once-use scenario. So you will play those assignment cards face down, and you will assign your leaders to them. Now, you start the game with four leaders on each side. So, you know, I played my first game as the Rebels, so I had Princess Leia, and I had a few other players. Now, pick the leaders. Leon, as you evil Empire, you started with Darth Vader and a few other big bads. But what you'll do is on the assignment phase is you'll put down however many missions you want. You could put down none, or you could put down all four. And you'll put a leader on top of those, signifying, I'm going to attempt this mission with this particular leader.
Mm.
This is where the first part of interest comes in. I want to get your thoughts on this, Leon, because the assignment phase happens where the Rebels do all of their mission assignment before the Imperial side does. Now, what that means is that the Empire, in essence, knows how many leaders are going to be assigned, because the other thing that leaders can be used for if they're not assigned to missions is moving the fleets around on the board or to oppose missions that the other player is doing. So in this assignment phase, the Rebels are telegraphing, I am going to put Princess Leia on this mission. Now, the Empire doesn't know what the mission is, but they know that she's not going to be used for something else. And what do you think about that, Leon?
Well, most importantly, you can see the symbols on those leaders that are going on those missions, because you can look at them and see, okay, he's used all his characters with, say, the yellow symbol on his mission cards, which means he couldn't use them to oppose me if I wanted to do stuff with yellow guys myself.
Yeah.
So then I kind of know cards that say you can attempt, I can pretty much guarantee you're going to go through because you can't stop me.
Yeah, so what the way that works is that there are four symbols in the game, and each leader will have one, two, three, or possibly all four symbols. There are the yellow ones, which is diplomacy. There are the blue eyeball, which is intel. There is the brown fist, which are the special operations. And then there's the other one, which is like infrastructure and building, which I don't know the name of.
It's like a little black tech symbol type thing.
Yeah.
So it's almost like they need some sort of dummy cards where you could put them down and you wouldn't know. And you know what you would call those cards?
May the Force be with us. It's a trap.
That would, of course, be the It's a Trap card.
There is an It's the Trap card.
Yes, but you don't need to know what the names of the things are at all. Like I just said, the little yellow symbols. Because all you need to know is colour to colour. You don't need to know what they're called really at all.
Yeah, exactly right. So the other side of that, though, is that it does create the opportunity for the bluff and double bluff side of things. Because there are two types of mission cards that Leon touched on. There is the attempt cards. And attempt cards are the ones that the opposing player can oppose. So the way that would work is you would put your leader in whatever system meets the criteria of the card. And I might say you attempt this mission in any rebel system or any imperial system or any subjugated system or any system that is populous. You put the leader in there, and then the opposing player has the opportunity to put one of their leaders from the leader pool, which means they haven't been assigned a mission themselves, to counteract that. You then do a roll off. The number of symbols equals the number of dice you're going to roll. Whoever has the highest number wins. So if I want to do it and I'm sending my Princess Leia to have that mission, if I roll three successes and Leon only rolls two, my mission succeeds and I get to do what's on the card. But if it's a draw or worse, then it just doesn't happen and I've basically forfeited my action.
Mm.
So you can create the bluff and double bluff because there are plenty of cards which will say resolve the situation, and resolve is it's just going to happen. You can't oppose it. So the Imperial player does have a lot of those cards up their sleeve, because not surprisingly, the Imperial side is powerful.
Mm.
The Imperials, you know, control the galaxy through fear and subjugation. So the Imperials have a lot of cards that just say, this is going to happen. But you still need to assign a leader for that mission. So the opposing player doesn't know whether the card you're assigning the leader to is an attempt, where they will have the opportunity to oppose it, or it's just a resolve. But it does allow the other player to go, oh, are they actually going to do this mission that's an attempt or resolve? And I like that. Then we go into the command phase, which is when you actually do all your actions. So that's when the leaders move off the cards. And this then goes alternate play by play. So you do one action, one action, one action, one action for each player. So it becomes a bit more tit for tat.
Which I really enjoyed, because every time that you did something, I was like, right, so he's done that with that character. So maybe I should try and do this now. But maybe I should try and do the other one, because I want to get that done quickly. But he's still got that leader that could oppose me. It's really entertaining.
Exactly. And this is the meat of the game.
Yeah.
So this game, there are potentially 16 rounds. I don't think I've seen one go past 6 or maybe 7 in the games that I've played so far. But in this command phase, you will do the missions, or you will move your fleets around, and essentially you have to place your leader onto a system, i.e. a planet, and they, for lack of a better term, suck any ships that are in an adjacent system to them. That's that simple. Or, as we said before, you can use them to oppose the missions from the other player. That's the command phase. And then the last thing is the refresh phase. Now, this is where you bring all your leaders back into your leader pool. You will then draw some new mission cards. The Imperial player then gets to draw 2 probe cards.
Bleep, bloop, 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 bloop.
Yes, very expertly done. So the probe cards are a deck of 30-something, which are the same number of systems or planets on the board. So this is signifying the tentacles of the Empire stretching ever further into the galaxy, and the Imperial player will then know, the Rebel base isn't on these 2 planets. Because the way that the Rebels are going to win is by hiding out and not having their Rebel base found for a long, long, long time, because they need to basically outlast the Imperial player. And also by completing objectives. There's a little objective deck that the Rebel player will draw one from every round. And that basically has, I guess, points that they are assigned. And there's this double-ended track where one end is the turn order, 1 through to 16. And then the other one is the, I forget the name of it, as I say. But it starts on 14. And every time the Rebel succeed in one of these objectives... that token goes down one number. And if the time track and this other tile ever are on the same space, the Rebels win. Mm-hmm. The Empire wins by finding the Rebel base and crushing the resistance that was in there.
So it's all about that base?
It's all about that base. About that base.
Mm.
So, after the several droids had been picked up by the evil Empire... then the Rebels will draw that objective card I just mentioned. We then advance that time marker, and then we get to recruit new heroes, because each player has a small deck of leaders that they draw 2 of them, and they choose whichever picture they like the most, or they look at the little standees with the leaders and the symbols on them and go, oh, I need a leader that has a lot of fighting fists, or I need a leader that has a lot of intel, or whatever the case may be. Mm.
Or
just one of those.
Or you just flip over the card and see Han Solo and go, mine!
Yeah.
Or see Boba Fett and go, mine! Which is exactly what we did the first round.
And in both games I played, I haven't seen Luke Skywalker out yet.
No.
Anyway, so then we each get one of those, and then on every second round, we also have a build phase, where every planet that is controlled by either the Empire or the Rebels, the vast majority of them, I should say, are populous, meaning they have a population, and they also construct certain, I guess, warfare machines. So they will conduct rebel troopers, or they might construct TIE fighters, or Corellian corvettes, or Star Destroyers, or whatever the case may be. So you build those, and the way they're built is that they have spaces 1, 2, or 3, which signifies the length of time that it takes to make, because that's the number of turns it'll take to make. And you go through all your systems, placing some of the 150 minis on there. The Empire will have a truckload more than the Rebels, and then you'll place them out on the board, because the last part of this is that you move everything that is on that build queue down one space. As soon as they slide off the board, you get to place them wherever you want, as long as there's no more than two in each of your systems that are loyal to you.
Remember that time when I was about to put out a second Death Star and a Super Star Destroyer?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter because I won the game before that happened.
Shut up.
But it was going to be fun.
So look, we're already running out of time. I know, we've only got 15 minutes left to go. So let's stop with the rules explanation, talk about this damn game, because it is a monster of a game.
But a good monster of a game.
It is a good monster of the game. I have played twice, and it was twice in one day. So it was quite a long day of Star Wars Rebellion. I had the pleasure of Leon coming round, and we played a two-player game, which went for on or around 4 hours.
Yeah. Didn't feel like it, though.
No, it didn't. And I really enjoyed playing the Rebels because of the feeling of just helplessness. When you have maybe two systems that are loyal to you versus the Imperials 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, when you see how few resources you are going to get on that build track, how few ships are going to be built on this next round versus the Imperials 25 gajillion things, and also the fact that what seems like almost every attempt mission was able to be counteracted by the Empire, or when I did do something, the effects of it, which, say, for example, like a sabotage, which means I've infiltrated this planet, I've sabotaged it, it's not going to construct any big, bad, nasty ships, troopers for the rebel, for the Imperials. It might last a round or two, but then that's it. But I just kept telling myself, you look at the Star Wars universe, and bar a few heroes, the Rebels were, they were in a lot of doo-doo.
Yeah, you're on the back foot the whole time.
The whole game.
Which is why I enjoyed playing as the Empire.
Yeah, you would.
Or the Imperials if you have, which I only just recently found out are the same thing. Even though I've been listening to people talk about Star Wars for years and say Empire and Imperials, and always assume they were something different. Just either way. So I enjoyed playing them because I liked the crush, kill, and destroy. The one negative I'd say, which is not even a negative, this is just me, I don't think I would really like being the Rebels as much because I think I'd just be anxious the whole time about somebody finding my boat. So it's things with something like Fury of Dracula, which is about 2 hours. I get that anxiety, but it's only about 2 hours, so it's not too bad. For a game like this that could really, really go on,
yep.
I think that it would get to me. That's why I love deception games, where it's like 5-10 minutes, it's like your resistance or your deception, where it's over and it's like, oh, thank God, I can get that out of my system now. So that would have been a bit difficult for me, but I think I'm one of the only people who would actually have that problem.
Yeah, and look, I really... See, my mind is the exact opposite, because I love that, because as the Rebels, it's all about being a sneaky guy. Or girl. So you've got the base where you know where your base is, but the Imperials don't. But then you might be setting up a whole bunch of strategies to lead the Imperials away on some red herring because you've got a planet there where you've put all your troops to so it looks really well defended. But you don't know what the Imperial player has drawn from the probe deck. So you're trying to send them up this garden path. They already know that that garden path is barren of any rebel activity, so they're going some other way because, oh, that's suspiciously left alone. And there's that, I know that you don't know what I don't think you know, and back and forth and back and forth. But then the rebels have the opportunity to play some cards which might put some of the probe cards that the Imperials have already drawn back into the deck, which adds to the confusion.
That was not fun.
But then the Empire has the ability to draw extra probe cards and get through that deck really, really quick. This first two-player game, it was tension for about 3 hours and 55 minutes. And then, unfortunately, it was utter rebel destruction for the last 5 minutes. And it went from super tense to being over.
Yeah. So my final quick thoughts on it is that I really did enjoy it. And for a game that's this long, I've played games like Android like 3 or 4 times. And I still have no bloody idea what I'm doing. Whereas this, after one whole round, I knew pretty much every facet of the game and knew what I was doing. The only negative I would probably say is that the combat with some of the dice that have the different symbols, the different colored dice, is a little bit... a little bit too... Not, I wouldn't say complicated, but it's just a little bit too messy. But other than that, it's rather good. But what I did want to know is... How do you go with four? Because as far as I'm concerned, I don't even think this should be a four-player
game. Well, how about I talk about that after this break?
That was The Cure with Boys Don't Cry. You're with Edge Radio and the Dice Men Cometh, 99.3 FM with Mark, Garth and Leon. Now, Garth, tell us about maybe how one boy did have a bit of cry in the four-player game.
Yeah, well, Leon, I really enjoyed our game. It was great fun.
I liked it. It was good.
I loved it so much that I then went and played it again as a four-player game. We finished at 4:45-ish.
Yeah.
I was playing it again by 6.
Oh, epic. Wow.
So it was basically enough time to pack it up, go to someone's house, and then unpack it again and start rules explanation again. But the main difference was this was a four-player game. Now, having just played and lost as the Rebellion, I thought, you know what, I'll play as the Empire because I want to get a rounded view of this game and blah, 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 blah. Now, I was playing this with Oren, who is part of our Star Wars Imperial Assault campaign. Aiden, who is a part of that campaign, plus is also currently GMing our Eclipse Phase Fate game, which is alternate Tuesdays normally. And then my brother-in-law, Trent, who was kind enough to host us. He was the last one to arrive, so the three of us are waiting in his backyard for him. Anyway, we played this game. I explained it again very similarly to how I'd explained it to you, set it up, went through the whole thing. The only real difference in a four-player game is you flip the little player board that each one has. The rules are sort of segmented a little bit. Each player plays two of the four starting leaders, and then there are one player's playing the Admiral, which means that they control certain aspects of the game. And the other player plays the general, which means they control other aspects. Now, one of the first segments that I ever prepared for when I started being an official Dice Man on the show was a segment called Bad Board Gaming Behaviour.
Yes.
Now, there were 20 types of bad board gaming behaviour. And unfortunately, one person at the table, and I'll leave it to your imaginations who this person was, exhibited about 35 of the 20 possible bad board gaming behaviours.
It's not bad. It's not bad.
Well, it is bad.
Oh, well, yeah, there's, yeah.
So for the table, we experienced around about, let's just say, 2.5 to 3 hours of whinging of, this isn't fair, this game's so unbalanced, of someone continuously knocking over our Death Star, of creating tremors in the Force, i.e. rocking the table back and forth. Complaining, yelling, blah, 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 blah. And not surprisingly, they were on the Rebel side. And even more not surprisingly, this person lost. Now, this is a first for me because this was Tuesday night. On a Wednesday morning, I received a little bit of a text message. And today, I received another text message, which I'd like to read out. And this is all in the interests of right of reply. Starting with, I feel that I should issue a statement with regards to Star Wars Rebellion. And I will read, and I quote, regardless of my personal views on the Star Wars franchise, or my familial relations with Garth, all my predispositions to view Fantasy Flight games as a cash-hungry, tree-eating, monster-sucking dollars from nerds around the world, I approached my first playing of Rebellion with an open mind. Unfortunately, the Empire's apparent abilities to know in advance which Rebel leaders will be deployed, its power to capture said leaders as a basic ability, and its additional resolve cards that cannot be opposed, led me to believe the game to be hopelessly one-sided, or it might have been a failure of instruction on my teacher's part. However, this does not excuse the next 3 hours of whinging, sniping, insulting, bitching, flicking of game pieces across the table, shaking of the board or physical assault, which I am absolutely guilty of, for which I wholeheartedly apologise. I am a bad player, and George Lucas made me do it is not an adequate excuse.
I bet you had to clean that up quite a bit.
No, I have read that.
Oh,
absolutely word for word, minus my surname.
Well, that's impressive.
Wow.
So that game highlighted quite a few things, actually. But the main thing was, I found out that playing as the Empire and playing as the Rebellion are two vastly different games. I really, really like this game. I have to keep reminding myself that you are meant to feel helpless as the rebel player. You are meant to struggle and figure out, is this going to work, and put those eggs in that basket and make it happen. Whereas as the Empire, it's basically, I'm going to find you. It's a matter of time. But it's amazing because in both of these games, it took 3 hours, 3.5 hours, 3 hours, 45 minutes for the base to be found. Not once in the two games that I've played has the Rebel player played the Rapid Mobilization card, which is one of their starting cards, which allows them to move their base to another planet if it's discovered. Or if it's not discovered, to bring a whole bunch of ground forces to it. Not once has that card been played, and maybe that in itself is something that we just haven't done right yet. I'm really curious to get this on the table again as a two-player and a four-player.
I was saying to someone the other day, actually, about this game, that I think this game would be brilliant for somebody, or a couple, that if they made a specific time, multiple playthroughs with the same person, is what I'm trying to say.
Yep.
I think you would benefit from that. Maybe you could switch sides, maybe keep it exactly the same. But this is a kind of game you could, if you had a mate that was really into it, you could get together once every couple of months, once every month, whatever, and just sit down and play this game. There's enough to it and enough variability, because the Rebel base is going to be somewhere different every time.
Agreed.
And different strategies, that you could do that. And this is coming from a person who is not the biggest Star Wars fan in the world. I don't actively dislike it, but the theme doesn't grip me.
Yeah.
But I would still happily play this again easily.
Yeah, I agree. There are a hell of a lot of the cards that haven't made it out yet out of their deck. My only advice would be that the gamer, the best gamer in inverted commas, the one who has the most strategic mind, should probably be the one who starts as the Rebels, because you want a player who can sort of figure out the game as quick and try and work those angles, because the Empire, it seems like it's a pretty straightforward crush, kill, destroy, whereas the Rebels, go out there and be sneaky.
I think that's all we've got time for, gents. Two amazing games, two amazing experiences. Let's leave the last words to Eric Bowersfeld. See you later.
May the Force be with us. It's a trap.
This has been an edit of The Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.